Adrian Wooldridge is the Washington bureau chief for The Economist magazine. He's also an atheist. And with John Micklethwaite, co-author of the book God is Back, How the Global Revival of Faith is Changing the World, Wooldridge says something very unexpected happened. Religion has not only survived, but thrived in the modern era, even though many people gave it up for dead.
What we're arguing in this book, essentially, is that there were two versions of the Enlightenment. There was the European view, particularly the French view of the Enlightenment, which argued that God, that is religion, and modernity were essentially incompatible, that the more modern the world became, the more it threw off the fetters of medievalism and feudalism and the rest of it, the more enlightened it would become, which meant the more agnostic or atheistic it would become. Then there was the American view, which was much more questioning than that, which said that countries could easily become much more modern, but at the same time retain a vigorous religious life, that there was no incompatibility between the two. Now, through most of the 20th century, it looked as though the European view, modernization equals the retreat of God, was the one that was winning. It was winning in countries such as Turkey. It was winning throughout the Islamic world, in the Middle East. It was winning, of course, in the communist world. Religion seemed to be on the retreat. Modernization seemed to equal secularization. There was one big exception to that, of course, which was the United States, where you had a vigorous religious life, plus, of course, in many ways, the world's most modern technology, the most advanced country in the world. But even in America, I think most intellectuals sort of thought of America as being the odd exception that eventually would catch up with Europe. Now, I think that what's happened over the last 25 years is a fundamental change, which leads me to think that, in fact, the world is going to go America's way rather than Europe's way.
Well, let's take some examples and explore them. The way you begin God is Back is with a tale about Shanghai, the Christian community there, what are called house churches. It sounds like a social club in some ways, the way you talk about it, but it is real Christianity and one that would be recognized just about anywhere.
What's going on in China is absolutely fascinating. You have in China, which of course not that long ago was an officially atheist country, you have somewhere between 80 million and 100 million Christians. It's a very Christian society. It's also a very Islamic society. There's a huge Islamic population there. But we went to a house church in Shanghai, and what we saw there was a group of people who were very professional. They were company executives, they were scientists, but they were all there in this rather luxurious apartment to worship God and to discuss the Holy Scripture. They spent several hours reading the Bible to each other, interpreting parts of the Bible, singing hymns, and they're part of this extraordinary thing called the house church movements, whereby people go to worship essentially in each other's homes.
What surprised me about the description was that some of the issues they discussed seemed more fundamentalist than you would expect from a group of intellectuals gathering that way, especially scientists. There was one of the members you talked about who was engaged in stem cell research, and yet the discussion ridiculed evolution. There seems to be a conflict, and it's that conflict between religiosity and modernism that is hard to explain, isn't it?
It's extremely hard to explain, and as you say, there's a very vivid example of this lady who spent all day studying stem cells but believed that they could not be accounted for by evolution. They needed to be divinely inspired because they were so beautiful. And yet the people there in that room didn't see this tension, which seems so obvious to us. They were happy to be fundamentalists, but also happy to be successful professionals and scientists. And if you ask them about the tension, they would say in their mind that Christianity in China was a symbol of China's modernization, a symbol of China's success. And they would say, well, atheism, that's all part of the old world. That's all part of, you know, the world of enforced communism, which brought poverty and degradation, and which has obviously failed. And so it seems strange to us, but it seemed absolutely, you know, not even a problem for them.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it? Because it suggests that the Christianity they are developing, while it looks like the one we're familiar with, isn't quite. I mean, this one, the way you describe it, seems to be a reaction against the suppression of religion during the communist rule, during Mao's rule, and yet you say they also still praise Mao.
It's very strange, but I think one of the things that you see there is Christianity, the notion of Christianity has become caught up with the notion of national greatness. They think that Christianity is one of the things that will make China once again a great country. They also see Mao is in some ways attempting at least to make China a great country. And so they think that they want to become Christian in order to become successful, entrepreneurial, commercially vigorous. And the country that they point to is, in fact, the United States. They say, look at the United States, this incredibly powerful, incredibly successful country, or up till now incredibly successful country. We'd like to be like them. And one of the things that have made them great is Christianity. So we want to embrace Christianity.
It also may be the source of some conflict, though, isn't it? I mean, Christianity is also experiencing a huge surge in Africa, but the kind of Christianity there has already developed some conflicts with the same sects in American churches. Are we going to see that same kind of conflict within the Christian world from country to country?
I think that the sort of conflict that we're likely to see is much more a conflict between Christianity and Islam. And what we see in Africa is a resurgent Christianity, particularly evangelical and Pentecostal Christianity, rubbing up against a resurgent Islam. And one of the most important places where this is happening is Nigeria, where you see Islam moving southwards, Christianity, a lot of it supported by American evangelicals, moving northwards. You see Islam and Christianity, both of whom are very aggressive religions, both of whom want to capture souls and bring souls to what they consider to be the truth, in conflict with each other. And I think this is a real potential for warfare, conflict, and disagreement.
Do you see evidence of the conflict between modernity and religiosity in the development of Islam?
I think a lot of Arab leaders essentially misunderstood the proper relationship between the church or the mosque and the state. What they essentially bought into was the European idea that in order to become modern, they needed to marginalize and essentially castrate religion. So you saw Ataturk, for example, pushing religion to one side, getting rid of the clerical hierarchy and introducing a form of secularism, which was, you know, a very French form of laicism, essentially moving religion entirely out of public life. You saw exactly the same with the Shah of Iran, who introduced a very secular regime and very deliberately marginalized the clergy. And they were looking to Europe, and particularly to France, as the model of how to do this. And I think this was a mistake. The model that they needed to look at was essentially the American model, which is, yes, you need to separate church and state and mosque and state to make sure that you have a level playing field between all different sorts of religions and make sure that the secular world and the religious world are separated in a formal way, but that doesn't mean that you can't have a vigorous religious life.
We've talked, of course, mostly about Christianity and Islam. There are a lot of other religions in the world, and there are a lot of very large sects in other places. We haven't even begun to talk about India, which does deal in both Christianity and Islam, but also there is Hinduism, there's Buddhism, and this is a huge part of the world. Are we seeing the same conflict between religiosity and modernism there?
One of the best pieces of research I think I did while writing this book was to go to a mega temple in Bangalore, which is, of course, the software capital of India. And I met the chief monk. He had a business card which said that he was the chief monk and CEO of the monastery. We had this huge boardroom with a big mahogany table and lots of leather-bound chairs all around it. We sat there, and he showed me a video on his flat-screen television. He gave me a PowerPoint presentation of what was going on in the monastery. This is a very, very, I don't know if you've ever been to a Hindu monastery, but the worship is, you know, obviously very, very traditional. It's been going on in the same way for hundreds and hundreds of years. You're transported back into a sort of what seems like an eternal world. And on the other hand, he was telling me that his monastery had been audited by Pete Marwick to make sure that it was very efficient, that on his board, he had a board of directors, which included many people from local software companies. They were conscious of running the monastery on the most up-to-date business themes. And one of the reasons he was doing this was that one of the fundamental commitments of his monastery was to feed the hungry. And this had always meant in the past that hungry people would come to the monastery and the monks would give them food. But he thought, should they just be coming to the monastery or we should be going to them? And so they set up a huge kitchen to make food to feed hungry school children. And so the monastery feeds now more than 100,000 school children in Bangalore. They have this huge kitchens with vast machines that create chapatis. They have hundreds of workers, and they prepare all this food. Then they put them into trucks. They have this huge modern fleet of trucks, which are actually covered with advertisements for various Philips electronic things. And these trucks all go out in the morning through the, you know, the traffic-clogged streets of Bangalore and distribute all this food. I ate some of the food. It was absolutely delicious to these school children. So they are applying modern techniques of advertising, of management, of mechanization, of organization to the preparation of food so that they can fulfill their ancient injunction to feed the hungry. It's a remarkable sight.
Adrian Wooldridge. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist magazine and co-author with John Micklethwaite of the book God is Back.